First of all, I must apologize up front that we decided to have this colloquium at 1 o'clock today afternoon. So I'm not really fully prepared in the sense of sort of making sure that everything is correct on the slide. So if there are errors, etc., please blame Satya for it, because he was out in the morning, so we couldn't finalize today. So there is a problem of that kind, but anyway, it's an interesting enough topic so that one should look at it. It has there's some interesting things that have happened recently. I think for 2 or 3 days ago, there was a paper in Nature where they have found 7 planets around object, if you wish, not even a star, and in many ways that makes this an interesting issue. And we will look at this idea from various perspectives. First, I will tell you what this is. So, if you are only interested in the aspect of what exactly was there in the paper, then you can sort of listen to a first few slides and leave. If you want to know the related issues, etc., you can stay longer. And like a newspaper, the longer you stay, the more details you get. And if you stay all the way through the talk, then you get a cup of tea at the end of it. Having said that, I'm sorry that I have to change my title because I typed it in a hurry. I think the original title had the family of seven stars, planets, etc., etc. And here I put this. Anyway, my name is Mayank Vaiya. That's a separate part of the story. So what is the seven sisters? What is the seven sisters that we are talking about? What is found is that there is a group of Belgian-led team of astronomers who have been looking at a very strange things. We have been looking for planets around stars for now almost 15 years, and we know of thousands of star planets around thousands of stars. It's become more or less routine. We know several star systems, etc. What the Belgian group did, and the reason why it has created so much excitement, is that they did not look at stars. What they have looked at are objects that almost became stars but not quite became stars, in the sense that they don't have nuclear reactions going inside them. They are still being heated by the gravity that formed them, and therefore they are rather considered uninteresting objects by astronomical standards. But as I will show you, it turns out to be a remarkably exciting piece of discovery. So this group of seven Belgians, etc., were looking at various objects, and they looked at one object at 40 light years away. And what they found was that they originally found 3 stars around it using their telescope, and they published it in Nature from a couple of years ago, but they were somehow not satisfied that they had fully understood what was going on. So then they asked for observations of the best telescopes, and then they found something even stranger than what they had originally started it. So their original discovery of 3 planets was published a little earlier. Now they have come out with this 7 planet. It's a part of a transit planet and planetarium, planetesimal small telescope program. It was essentially a small telescope program looking at an object 40 astronomical units away, an object that almost made it to a star, didn't quite make it to a star, so something that people would not have been interested in, until of course, surprise, surprise, they found these 7 planets. They also used, and I'll come to that a little later, but well, right here, they used a Spitzer telescope. Now, Spitzer telescope is absolutely top of the line infrared telescope that died a year ago. In the sense that infrared telescope require helium cooling, and this telescope ran out of its cooling system and all that, so it was considered now no more capable of doing high quality science. So it was available for all kinds of observations, and then they used it to observe this object, and it turns out to be one of the most spectacular observations from Switzer telescope for various reasons that I will show. So there is a lot of drama involved in that. There is a serendipity involved, there is a chance observation of using a nearly dead satellite on an object which was always considered uninteresting to be observed, and yet there are some strange surprises that come out from it. In the final observation, for 20 days they used the telescope along with other telescopes at Chile, Hawaii and South Africa to look at this object. They just looked at this object and collected light. That's all that they did, and I'll show you what they found. They found 7 planets, and I'll show you how they found the 7 planets. And out of these seven, in principle, all of them can harbor water in the liquid form, because the star itself is not very hot, or the object, central object itself is not very hot, and we will look at that. And the orbits have a very peculiar property that they are integral multiples of each other, which is also something extremely unusual. So to add to the original drama of the seven sisters, there is this drama that if the orbit of the first satellite is some number A, the second satellite is a multiple of that, and third satellite is a multiple of third, and all that. And that is, again, that is not expected. It's not something that you expect. The only place where you have seen this kind of resonance, where the orbit of one is a multiple of the other, is in the case of Jupiter. And in case of Jupiter, we know that the three objects, that the Galilean moon of Jupiter, have a particular kind of locking, which makes them go in this resonant orbits, and that tells you about a long, old, stable system. So this is one more drama that was there about the resonant orbits, which, like I said, we have never seen in a stellar system. We have only seen it in Jupiter. And that raises some interesting problems about what is going on, and I'll come to that by and by. The two innermost planets we now know have a thick atmosphere of hydrogen, and how they found it, etc., and whether we can look at atmosphere of others, is something that I will try and answer as we get along. And this, just to remind you, the Earth takes 365 days to go around the Sun. These are around the Sun, while these objects take somewhere between 1.5 to 12.5 days to go around the star. So they are extremely close to the star. Then they are much, much closer than even the orbit of Mercury, because Mercury also takes 80 days to go around the Sun. Well, these things are extremely far moving, and yet there is something promising about these, because the original star is so faint, so weak, with surface temperature of 2000 degrees Kelvin compared to the Sun, which is 6000 degrees Kelvin, that even though they are so close, they hold a certain promise of having life. This is what they saw. They looked at the star. The normal light would come at a particular intensity. These fluctuations are very typical of observing through CCD and stuff like that. Until they came, you would think that these seem to be at random, and of course nothing happens at random. So they started fitting patterns on it, and what you see is this purple squares and yellow squares and green squares, etc. Each of these was assigned to a particular assumed planet. So what happens is, just to go through, when a planet comes in front of the star, it obstructs a bit of the light of the star. So the light intensity was coming from this star. When the planet is in front, that light would dip. Now if you look at this orbit, it isn't a single planet that would fit that, because planets have a perfect periodicity, and you don't see that periodicity. So they assumed that there was more than one planet, and when they kept on doing it, eventually they found that they needed seven planets to fit this observation. And once they had fixed that this was planet 1, planet 2, planet 3, planet 4, they looked at the light curve as to what happens. So if you now look at the specific planet's orbit, what you see is time from here, and the planet number 1 showed this kind of a dip, planet number 2 showed this kind of a dip, and planet number 1 to 7 showed a variety of dips. There are several things that the dips will tell you. The first thing that the dip tells you is how big the planet is, because obviously how much area it covers decides how much light is absorbed. So the first thing that it tells you is what is the orbit of the planet. This tells you how what is the orbit of the planet, and this tells you what is the size of the planet. So the greater the dip, bigger the planet, and the longer it lasts means it is covering the surface of the star for a longer time, or it is further away from the star. So this planet is the closest to the star, and this is the farthest from the star. This is apparently the largest, and this seems to be the smallest, but you have a small one over here also. So you can determine the size of the planet and its distance from the star just by looking at this much. And when you plot it on the object is in the middle, our star, planet number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 are in this kind of an orbit, and you can determine and calculate the entire parameter set once you have this little graph with you. It totally eclipses, in the sense that the planet is right in front, completely obstructing the light. Otherwise, we wouldn't have seen. So this is another very powerful thing about this, is that we are seeing this entire disk exactly edge on. All the planets are in the same plane, and because we are seeing it exactly edge on, we can see this perfect eclipses. Which is, so there are several very interesting, curious, unexpected, and exciting things about this observation. And when you do that, there were seven planets were, three of them perhaps you can probably cannot see, but for two, three, for four, five and six, they have painted the orbit back in gray because that area is of exceptional interest. And if you have a planet in that area, you are talking about something exciting, and I will come to that in a minute. So this is what has been happening. The planet has been transiting the star, that has been killing the light, and by knowing how long it kills the light, you know how much time it has taken to transit, and by knowing how much is the dip, you can make out how big that planet is, and therefore you have the entire story of the seven planets. This is what the comparison looks like. Jupiter, if you look at, the diameter of the planet is about 130,000 kilometers, and it has these four great Galilean moons which are in the outer orbit. If you look at the Sun, the diameter is 1.4 million kilometers, and it has Mercury, Venus and Earth and Mars roughly in this size. So the diameter of the Sun gives you the size of the object that you are talking about. And if you look at the current star that we are interested in, then it has seven objects somewhere between the size of Mercury and the size of Earth, and they are fairly close to it compared to what Earth planets are. Another interesting feature of this object is that even though they have shown spots and stuff like that, the fact is that this star object is so small that the central pressure, the pressure in the middle of this star or middle of this object, would not be heavy enough to start nuclear burning. So it is still burning through various chemical reactions and electron pressures and stuff like that. It is not a genuine star. It's something that just about failed to be a star. You can imagine at 40,000 kilometers, Jupiter is not a star, and at what about 162,000 kilometers. It's marginally bigger than the, it's about 20% bigger than Jupiter and much, much smaller than Sun. And yet the object glows a little. It has a surface temperature, like I said, Jupiter's surface temperature is very low. It's about 80 degrees Kelvin. This is about 2000 degrees Kelvin, and this is about 6000 degrees Kelvin. So it's a rather dark, relatively uninteresting object, except that it harbors all this, which also tells you that the cloud from which this system formed must not have been a very great cloud, because the amount of material that got gathered in the center was not enough to start a star, but there was enough dust lying around which formed all these objects that it did. Then you can do much more than just looking at the star, because of the fact that, for example, this aspect is when the star is getting out of the eclipse, and this is where the planet is getting, planet is getting into the eclipse and out of eclipse. You can actually look at the passage of light from the edge of the planet. And if the planet has no atmosphere, the radiation will reach you straight away. On the other hand, if you have a cloud, you will actually get some amount of absorption. So the line of going out of eclipse will become a little fuzzy, and therefore you won't be able to see a very sharp dip that you saw in the earlier thing. And that tells you the kind of atmosphere it has. And we know about the seven star system that at least the first two have a hydrogen rich environment, atmosphere. So it actually has a hydrogen rich atmosphere. For the other five, we don't know, because we haven't still made the measurements with the accuracy that we want. But at least for the first two, we know that there is an atmosphere sitting around it. Now the problem with, I also told you, and I made some song and dance about the fact that these orbits are in resonance. And the only case we know it is in Jupiter, and resonant orbits don't happen naturally. The only way resonant orbits happen is if the planets are moved. So these planets probably did not form where you see them today. They probably formed much further away. And as they were getting herded in for whatever reasons, they eventually stepped down into these orbits, which have nice periodicity. The corresponding example we have for the solar system, where we don't have the resonance, but we do know that from the past history, the planets have moved. So what you have here is time scale since the birth of the solar system till today. And what you have is the distance of various planets, and you can see that Jupiter was originally formed slightly inside. In fact, it went significantly inside, almost coming to Earth's orbit, before it eventually guided, had a bit of resonant movement, and eventually settled down to its present position of 5 AU. So Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and and we have really no good data about our inner planets to know whether they moved or not. But these big objects we know, have moved, we know that the objects that were originally over here, the red colored dots, are now in a much smaller number. The blue colored dots have also come in. So essentially materials move within a star forming region, and we suspect that the same thing must have happened to this object that we are talking about, because the way the seven sisters are structured in their resonant orbits is not something that would have happened by chance. The other important thing is something called the habitable zone around a planet. Habitable zone by definition is something in which you can live, and the habitable zone is defined in a very peculiar manner. I'll come to the exact definition in a minute, but essentially if you want to have life, you need molecules that can replicate themselves. To be able to replicate themselves, they should know what they look like, and the best part that you have is carbon, because carbon has this 4 valency band. Plus carbon can react with all kinds of elements. It can make this flexible long chain, it can make this close chain. It's such a versatile molecule that we are almost certain that life anywhere in the universe will consist of carbon. In principle, silicon also has 4 valency band if you look at the periodic table, but though silicon is heavier than carbon, so the whole thing is much more glass. And the second problem is the silicon is not as abundant as carbon is, and so essentially we think all life consists of carbon. Now the moment you say that all life consists of carbon, water is an excellent companion for it. So essentially we believe that water or some liquid that is liquid around that temperature, even lower, and carbon will make a good companion. Now, so if you need these two, it immediately puts a limit on that. If your planet is so close to the star that water gets dissociated because of the light of the sun, then you cannot have water there, and therefore you cannot have life. If you are so far away that carbon essentially settles down as carbon dioxide, again there won't be the dynamics necessary to support life. So you can put a limit for any given star as to how far you can be and still have a comfortable environment in which you can live. So for the sun, which is one solar mass, you have roughly an habitable zone that is somewhere over here. For a smaller star, you have a habitable zone over here, and for a larger star, you have a habitable zone over here. You really don't worry about stars much larger than this, simply because those are rather unstable in terms of their surface activity and all that, so habitation is not going to be a possibility. On the other hand, the habitat that we are talking about is right somewhere here on this scale. So this star has to come all the way down for a period of few minutes, a few days, and yet you will have a habitable zone. So what is exactly this habitable zone? The habitable zone of a star is where if you put a planet with correct mixture of everything, and then the sun solar radiation will provide it nice warm environment. The idea, like I said, is that it should support liquid water, and therefore water should not dissociate in the sunlight. If you take the Earth at 0.95 AU, essentially you will lose all the water. So you can go up to 0.95 AU towards the sun. On the other end, if carbon dioxide condenses off, then carbon dioxide condensation will prevent the carbon cycle from happening, and therefore you will not have life. For the case of the sun, it is 1.4 AU, and obviously you notice that Mercury, Mars, 1.5 AU is now no longer in the habitable zone of the sun. So if you were living on Mars in the early period when the sun was slightly hotter, you would have frozen to death by now. We have known of other cases where, so you have 0.95 AU to 1.37 AU, and Mars is at 1.5 AU. Just for the sake of completeness, when the sun was young, it was slightly hotter, and therefore this band allowed Mercury to be within the habitable zone. But after a few hundred million years since the birth of the sun, Mercury is out of favor as far as life is concerned. So just to go back, there are other cases where we have seen. So there is, for example, Kepler mission was dedicated to look at planets, and they have found one system where there are 4 planets very close to the star, but one in the habitable zone. So this gray color that you have is the band of habitable zone, and the size of the circle that you have will tell you how big the planet is. And the red ones are too hot to be able to support life. The green ones seem to be in principle in the habitable zone. So we have known some systems where we have had planets in the habitable zone, but you have this, for example, Jupiter sitting in between the planet and the star and so on. There are various cases where we know there are planets which have been pointed at Earth-like and so on and so forth, where habitation, in principle, they are within habitable zone of the star. But being in the habitable zone means is an essential condition, but not a sufficient condition. It is necessary to be in the habitable zone, but just because you are in the habitable zone doesn't mean you will have life. The planet could be too large, too small, too highly elliptical or whatever you have it, in which case life will not be possible. But being in the habitable zone, at least you have crossed the first hurdle of having life. The other systems, we know Kepler 62 was famous, and lots of articles on that about a couple of years ago, where we know the first three planets which are inside, which are not very good, but there are two planets roughly the size of the Earth, which again are within the habitable zone and therefore are promising for life. In case of solar system, of course, we know that Mercury is inside, Venus is at the inner edge, Mars is at the outer edge, and only the Earth sits right in the middle of the habitable zone. But we have some other cases also. You can sorry.
The Kepler 62 was active in X-ray, so that's another problem.
Yeah, that's a problem. So you have to worry about how big the central star is. So that's what I'm saying, that there are a lot of things that the star can do which can spoil your chances of having life, and just being in the habitable zone is not sufficient to have life. Okay. So if you look at the mass of the planet against the radius of the planet, you essentially measure the density of the planet, and you can actually tell you about the composition of the planet. So if you, for example, if you are a 100% iron planet, then its mass radius relation will be like that. If you are 100% essentially consisting of 75% water, you will be somewhere like this. The Earth sits on this black band, which is the most comfortable, where you have enough kind of all kinds of material in sufficient quantity. And we know some planets which seem to be quite close to that band of nice rocky planet, and some that are clearly very far away from this nice rocky planet. So this essentially, for example, is just gaseous. I mean, you're not going to find even a strong surface on that. But over here on this band, we have a lot of planets which are promising in the sense that they are at least Earth-like in their density. But they could be very large, and they may not have other parameters. So again, being on this line is a necessary condition and not a sufficient condition. We know, If you had asked me about 6 months ago, I would have said that this is the list of potentially habitable planets, roughly sun size, roughly Earth size, roughly at the correct distance from the star within the habitable zone, roughly circular orbits and so on. So in principle, we have a list of about a dozen planets or so, which are potentially livable. I also want to clarify that the search area that we have been covering is not very large. The telescopes that we use to determine life on habitable planets and search for planets are not sensitive enough really to go into very deep space. So we are looking at very close neighborhood within about 100 light years or so, where we have searched for planets. So almost 60% of the planets that we know, or stars that we know, seem to have planets of some kind or the other. And the number of habitable planets seems to be less than 1% of that number.
And the mass estimates are coming from the
velocity,
right?
Yeah, you have eclipse, the eclipse, the size comes from eclipse, the mass comes from here, exactly. Okay, so Pegasus 51 was one of the most favorite planets that we have had, because it is close by. It's within a lifetime a person can send a signal to that planet, because it's 20 AU or so. You can actually send a signal to it and hope to listen to the answer to Pegasus. But now, of course, Pegasus has been taken over. We also know several multiple planet systems. Now, multiple planet systems are more interesting in the sense of being more useful. For example, if you take life on Earth, a single comet impact 65 million years ago wiped out 90% of life on Earth, including dinosaurs. So a cometary impact can have a devastating effect even on a habitable planet. We are talking about the typical probability of having such an impact is once in a few hundred million years, simply because we have Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune working as gigantic vacuum cleaners, which make sure that we don't have too many comets coming and hitting the Earth. You remove Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune from the solar system, and the probability of having of cometary impact on Earth roughly turns into once in a few thousand years. And if once every few thousand years, if the life is going to be wiped out from your planet, its evolution to intelligent life is not going to be possible. So planets protect each other. So multiple planetary systems have a better chance of having life than single planet. We know about solar system in the convention that the US solar is Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. Pluto is not a planet, it has been disqualified some time back. We know other cases where there are two giant Jupiter-like planets. We know other cases where there are a few times bigger than the Earth. We also know some more solar systems. The best that we knew until recently is this five planet system around a star. And now we have seven, of course. We have also seen, I was talking about habitable zone around the star, we have also seen that if you go from a star, an actual image of a star, where beyond a certain limit of protostellar disk, about 34-30 AU or so, you actually don't see ice. So within this disk where the star is being born, you don't see any water inside about 30 AU or so. The ice line is over here, water ice line over here, it's about 10 AU or so. Below that, you don't see any water. Essentially, the star is so hot that all water evaporates away and is either photodissociated or simply moves out into the outer regions. So if you see also the idea that there is a habitable zone plus the fact that you need this water means something, because if you look at Earth, for example, when the Earth was born, the sun was hotter and there really would have been no water on Earth. All the water on Earth has been photodissociated or evaporated away and moved to outer region because we are inside this water line. The water that we drink today, the water that we see on Earth today, came from a couple of cometary impacts that fell on Earth soon after the Earth was born, when the sun had cooled down enough so that the water could be sustained on Earth. But otherwise, when the sun was being born, when the sun and solar system was being born, there would have been no water. So if the star that we are looking at, if it had been originally very hot, then the planets that you see inside would not have had water. But now we have some indication, and therefore we would not have taken any interest in it. But now we know from resonant orbit that these planets were very far away, probably outside this water zone where they would have saved the water. And after the planet star cooled down, if they have come inside, then they could be carrying water. Otherwise, planets so closer than the orbit of Mercury, would not have had water. All the water would have got burnt out. But because of studies like this, and the fact that there are resonant orbit, means that you probably kept the planet had managed to keep their water before they moved to the habitable zone inside the star. So that makes another drama. Can you photograph these things? Right now we have only seen absorption line. The best that we have done, and it's quite impressive, at 100% we have managed to photograph a planet around a star. The star is in the middle, which has been removed from the image, and then you can see the planets around that star. But remember that this distance is fairly large. The Earth is at 1 AU, 1 astronomical unit from the Sun. This planet is at 82 astronomical unit from the planet. So photographing something that is so close to the star is not going to be easy because the star light would have absorbed it. The second problem, of course, is that this is a face-on system where the star is going around the planet. Here you are looking at the system edge. So we are not going to get a photograph of this object very quickly. So the idea to look at it, if you look at stellar mass and if you look at the temperature, the object that we are talking about, TRAPPIST-1, is essentially somewhere over here with its various objects. It's a brown mass about 0.06 times the mass of the Sun. And then you have smaller planets. There are other dwarf stars around which planets have been seen. And these are the Sun-like stars. And lots of planets have been seen around the Sun-like stars. But around Sun-like stars, if you go to Earth, essentially, you lose the chance of having. So all these planets which are very close to the star will be simply too hot to have life. On the other hand, that are farther away, there is some hope that there might be life on it if other conditions are normal. And we will come, I'll skip this for the timing. Other conditions are normal, then you can have life. But before we ask the question of where life will be, the obvious question to ask is what is life? And that turns out to be a non-trivial question, because when we see life, we know it is life, but we don't know how to define life in an objective manner. Okay? We find it easier to define life by what it is not. In any case, we will assume that life does the following, that it consumes food, it reacts to the environment in a complex manner. By the way, this slide effect is not what I had given. It's thanks to the projector here. It grows and so silicates, and it produces a large number of chemical reactions. You take a basic sort of something that you call life, something that consumes food, something that reacts to environment in a complicated manner, and the word complicated manner of course is not defined. It grows and self-replicates and it produces a large number of chemical reactions, but salt crystal forming in a supersaturated water solution will also do all these things, and we know it is not living. So this is in some sort of more sufficient condition. Plus, to avoid crystal-like development, you would say that the complexity has to be aperiodic, and that gives you a lot of problems, because how do you produce these kind of things? A more accurate definition, if you look at dictionary, it says a living object is a region which uses energy to maintain organization against disruptive forces of entropy. And frankly, this definition says nothing. It's impossible to use this as a criterion to look for life. Okay, so we will stay with this. But the very fact that you stay with this means there are two things. The molecule knows what it looks like, and the molecule knows how to make a copy of itself by using other molecules in its environment. Just this much tells you that carbon is what is best placed for life, because carbon is suitable in many, many ways. It accepts both acidic and basic atoms. It forms closed and open chain chemicals. It is easily available in the universe, and it has this nice friend called water. Water is chemically simple. It's an excellent solvent and therefore can make everything available to carbon. It remains liquid over a wide range of temperatures and pressures, and it has this nice triple point advantage where if you cool it beyond its freezing point, it actually expands, and therefore ice floats on water. So if you have life in water and the planet goes into freezing, the water below will remain as water and the top layer can freeze, and therefore life will not freeze. If it was to freeze bottom up, essentially all life would get frozen out. But the very fact that there is a triple point means it provides a certain protection to waterborne life. It has a specific heat and high vapor pressure, which means it can sustain a lot of heat without passing it on as vibration to the molecule and creating problem. Silicon in principle, like I said, does have some long molecules, but it does not have a lot of other advantages it does. So I think there's a fair consensus to say that life in the universe will be carbon based. Just because it will be carbon based, it doesn't mean, by the way, that it will be oxygen breathing. And there are people who have speculated that instead of water, you can even use methane options in which you can do this kind of thing. So there is some leeway for playing this, but not too much. Also, there are other problems with life. For example, if you look at nature, you find everything is in random order. There is really no order between these letterings. This random arrangement is the most common. There is a T there which you can't see. Okay. On the other hand, if you make a crystal out of it, you will see periodicities of element, but in between there can be randomness, which is not very useful. I know how to go from here to here. But the question is, you want to go here. You want to create complex molecules. You can create random complex molecules from this kind of crystalline structures and overlying chemistry. And this we know how to do. We can go either from this or from this. What we need is information containing molecules that know what they look like and how to make copies of themselves. And this we have no real clue as to how to make. Some people have suggested that you probably make lots of random carbon systems, and then some of them will be self-replicating, and we will see some of these issues later. Others have suggested that maybe you go through here, use carbon to make random complex molecules, and then create them information forming. Or go straight from here through processes that we don't understand and form molecules that have a perfect grammar, and therefore they know how to make copies of themselves. But really, we also need to prevent the backscatter, because thermodynamics, for example, the heat will invariably do that. Thermodynamics does not like ordered systems, and therefore anytime you see a large ordered system, the heat in the system will try to break it up. So you need to do a lot of work to maintain these things out of equilibrium. So you can define the acidity or pH level of the water in which you can have life. You can define the temperature range in which you can have life, and salinity in which you can have life. And you get a rather limiting box within which life must exist. So anywhere you are looking for life in the universe, the parameters on the planet will have to be within this set. And that again is a sufficient condition. It is not a necessary condition and not a sufficient condition. There are some interesting recent results that have come out. For example, people have tried to simulate what happens when a comet impacts the Earth. Okay, in order to do that, what they did was, somewhere it says here, so they showed that energetic reactions at high pressure can actually produce molecules, and I will show you the example of that. So let me just show you. What they did was that they simulated an atmosphere like environment and used high power laser to create shock fronts. When they do that, even the normal air with carbon and oxygen and nitrogen sort of breaks down into various kinds of complex molecules. And therefore, you can have a bunch of chemical reactions which seem to create random carbon-based molecules. And you can imagine that if this particular shock front also carried its own large complicated molecules, you can actually have a pretty good chemistry going on here. The other set of results are that people have identified how do you accumulate large molecules. And what they have done is that around these heat vents, they took some samples of rock, and they found that if you take large molecules going through vents, then in the porous rock around it, there is a certain amount of movement of these molecules, and as the time passes, the dilute liquid that you had in the beginning with heavy molecules, over a period of time, actually gathers heavier molecules. So it selectively chooses heavier molecules to be gathered, and the lighter molecules essentially pass through the sieve, and you have natural sieves occurring in heat vents where you actually collect these large potentially information carrying molecules, and then they can find their cousins through which they can make copies of themselves. The third interesting result that has come almost earlier this year, where they have looked at what the comets consist of through various missions that have actually gone in situ and looked at comet composition, and they find that there are a lot of complicated carbon compounds that you can see on these objects, fairly large molecules with hundreds of atoms and so on. You can find them because these meteorites must have actually formed so far away from the sun that they could take these objects, volatile material and other material, make complicated molecules and store them on their surfaces, and therefore when they would come and hit the Earth, you would essentially have the situation where you have this shock front which in fact carries a large load of organic molecules to begin with, and then takes an advantage of this chemical reactions that happen in the atmosphere under shock conditions to produce things that are interesting. So we have now cometary data. So on Rosetta, for example, Rosetta mission actually landed on a comet after some 15 years of interplanetary travel and so on, actually found a lot of non-volatile and volatile organic molecules, including things that are highly volatile ices on this comet. So, and then subsequently this year, of course, there is a NASA mission which has also confirmed on another comet that you have, in this case it has confirmed on actually a meteor that you can find this kind of rare elements, rare compounds in the case of these surfaces. So you have this kind of objects. The fourth major result, which again came out I think late last year or early this year, is how do you make life? Life is not just a question of an RNA self-replicating itself, but anything that is good essentially is a cell life. So you not only need a nucleus which can do chemical reaction, which can store information, etc., you need to be able to collect water around it and make a cell surface and all that. And that seemed to be an impossible step until somebody did an interesting experiment. What they did was they took droplets of high concentration of complex mixture of molecules, kept them away from thermal equilibrium, from the equilibrium, so the thermodynamics won't spoil it, and then they get an interesting result, and I'll just show you the result, where if you take the saturation level of compounds in that against the temperature, against the turnover, how quickly they split and all that, normally you would expect the molecules to split into two, but you actually get fairly stable droplets of water entangled by the property of the fluid, and you can imagine that if you put one of the living molecules inside it, they will control the chemistry of it, and you have a brief idea about what complicated cellular life must have come out from. And you can see under various conditions of saturation and turnover time, you get some molecules which form stable droplets around which a self-replicating molecule can go ahead and build its cell, and therefore build further life. So life may not be that common in the universe, because the other problems, thermodynamics is something that I've been talking about. Also, to make life you need carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, etc., which didn't exist in the early universe. They were all born in the cores of stars. So you need a star which is old enough to have this kind of material. It needs a long stable lifetime because these things take millions of years to evolve. And if your star is not very stable or patient, it will not have life. Degree of eccentricity of the orbit is an issue. If the planet is highly elliptical, then it will cool down very quickly and so on. Plus, you need protection from UV radiation. The problem is that UV radiation has the correct wavelength to destroy your chemical bonds of organic material. And therefore, for example, we use UV light for water filters because they are very good at destroying organic life. And UV radiation from the sun, similarly, can sterilize the earth. And that is why we need the ozone protection. And you need that ozone protection in the planet in which you want to create life. Yeah, then again your UV radiation will essentially kill you, or the heat itself will kill you. So mercury, for example, is some 400 degrees on one side and 80 degrees on the other side. It takes life. Evolution of intelligent life is another set of issues. Taking life from simple self-replicating molecules is not an easy thing because you have to convert molecular life to cellular life. You have to take cellular life to create multicellular life. I mean, why would a particular molecule cell give up its ability to reproduce itself in the favor of protecting some other cell so that when that cell is reproduced, this cell also will be reproduced? It's a difficult question to answer as to how do you get multicellular life. Sexual reproduction, which produces significantly more fitter offsprings, but it's a major jump in evolution which we don't understand. We need evolution of intelligence to survive. Remember, if dinosaurs had ruled the earth, the mammals would not have been got any bigger than a mouse or something. At the time of dinosaurs, the only mammals were about rat size because anything bigger would have been eaten up by dinosaurs. So you needed the destruction of dinosaurs for mammals to take over the earth. Technological advances you need beyond survival instinct if you want to talk about intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. And so that brings me to a very various issues. So the large number of parameters that are needed for life on Earth is that you need a correct star. You need at least a third generation star, so it has enough material to form a star. The star should be isolated, otherwise the planets won't remain around it. You need a stable star, because if the star is unstable, then it will destroy life on the planet. You need correct configuration of the planets in the sense that the planet size and structure should be correct. Remember that a massive amount of erosion is happening on the surface of the Earth, and all that goes and settles at the bottom of the sea, and that material is effectively lost. Unless you have volcanic activities and other internal heat in the planet, which keeps on recirculating this material on Earth, essentially planet will become barren. So you need a planet of the size and containing enough heat to be able to recirculate its material. You need moon to stabilize the rotation of the Earth, Jupiter to stabilize the revolution of the Earth, plus of course keep other comets away from hitting us. You need circular orbit, because otherwise you will have problems of freezing out. You need complex geological upheaval to regenerate material and so on. You need a correct environment, you need correct temperature range, you need correct mix of elements. You need a magnetic field and ozone layer to prevent the solar radiation from, or stellar radiation from killing you. And can this all be found at any other place is anybody's guess. But the reason, for example, the present object is interesting is because it is not a star. It has failed to be a star. So you don't require magnetic field and ozone layer because it is so cold at 2000 degrees Kelvin that it is not really emitting too much in UV light and so on. So even if the planet is close by, it might still be able to sustain life. So brings you down to Drake's equation, which was written some time back, where he had all the white colored terms. It now turns out that as we understand more of life on Earth, we need to add a few more terms. Essentially, what it does is P is the total probability of finding life in the universe. PT is the total number of stars in the galaxy. We can take them as 10 raised to 11. PS is the total number of stars that are in the correct size. That comes to have about 20%. Percentage of stars around these planets is about 80%. Percentage of stars with planets within habitable zone is about 10%. Beyond this, we have very little idea. Percentage of planets in stable circular orbits, we have no clue. Percentage of planets where life has evolved, we have no clue. Percentage of planets where life has moved beyond simple molecules, percentage of planets the life has gone into multiple cellular, a whole bunch of questions about which we know nothing. And of course, the question is whether we can hear them, because the signal from Earth, for example, the first television transmission was about 50 years ago, or radio transmission was about 100 years ago. So beyond 100 light years, the signal from Earth has not even reached. So if you ask me to make a wild guess, I would think that if you look at the level of intelligence against the number of planets with life, you probably have something of a power law form, and Earth would be somewhere at the far end. Whether there is something beyond that is something that one needs to guess. And the last question, of course, is can we ever meet them? So I'll just put last two slides about whether we can meet them. What we have here is the distance of exoplanet that we have seen and the number of exoplanets we have seen. So about 20 exoplanets, 10 exoplanets are within 10 AU and so on. Contacting them will not be easy because of the vast distances of the universe. And as far as we know, Einstein's theory of relativity is correct, which means that you cannot exceed the velocity of light. And if the light, even light takes 20 years to come from that object to us, human beings cannot travel at anything comparable to velocity of light. So if you take, for example, of the modern rocket that I have, that we have, typically they travel at 1/100th the velocity of light. So if light takes 10 years, we are going to take significantly more than that. So essentially the first human being, first Homo sapien who came on Earth and sent up a rocket, it would just about be reaching the nearest habitable planet. So we are talking about absolutely long distances, and as long as relativity is correct and we have no reason to doubt it so far, we have a problem about not being able to contact them. But in any case, just for fun, you can speculate about contacting other beings. First of all, if there are living beings, have they overcome the nuclear barrier? Or once they declared, found out nuclear weapons, did they kill each other with them? We are at the borderline. We are not so sure whether we have cleared the nuclear barrier. But we don't know whether other civilizations destroyed themselves with that. Did they avoid other ways of self-destruction? Pollution is one way of self-destruction and so on. How many of them had stable planets with stable environment and all that, so that they could survive for long? If advanced, are they really keen on exploration of the universe and whether they can get over relativity or not? If they are keen on exploration, they would essentially be violent. It's safe to assume that they would be violent. Maybe they have noticed our radioactivity, because like I said, about 100 light years from here, you can see radio signals from Earth. Then there are questions about whether we are, and these have been favorite questions of science fiction writers, but I'm just list them out for completeness, because if I had finished earlier, Satya wouldn't give me the frame. So, will they come in person? Will they send robots? Will they send atom bombs to evict us first and then come and inhabit this beautiful planet? Some have argued that the very fact that we have not had visits from interstellar travel of super intelligent beings essentially means that they don't exist, and I don't believe in all the sightings of UFOs. The bottom line therefore is that we have an interesting object over here, potentially capable of life, but from just knowing that there are seven planets around a particular object doesn't mean we have found life. There's a long journey to be covered before we can talk about finding life anywhere else in the universe. Thank you very much. Yes. Proxima Centauri, I did not mention, partly because I forgot, but the reason is the Proxima Centauri B is an object that is 3 light years away from here, and we have seen a planet around that. The problem with Proxima Centauri B is that it's a triple star system. So there are these 3 stars going around each other, so we really are not sure whether there will be a stable orbit enough in a habitable zone. So it's interesting to see that a triple star system actually has a planet. So essentially it's a 4 object system. But from the life point of view, it may not be very interesting. Yes?
Yes. Having life is one point. Being habitable is another point.
Correct.
Maybe we can make that association from where we can launch further exploration. We already told that there are some planets which are inhabitable zone.
Yes.
Whether we can go and colonize there, from where we can explore other planets.
In principle, yes, but currently we don't have a technology. See, there are people who have talked about launching a satellite and then putting high power laser, giving them a sail and then putting high power laser, and theoretically they can claim that they can go to a velocity roughly 1/5 the velocity of light. Whether that is reality or not is a different question. But there have been speculations like that. If you can have a fast moving vehicle, maybe an object that is 20 light years away can be reached in 40 years. But we have problems. We don't even know how to create an artificial biosphere. All our attempts have failed. We don't even know whether we can go to that kind of velocities or not. So in principle, in theory, it is possible that you can go planet hopping or planetary system hopping. But as of now, it seems to be beyond our technological or even physics wise understanding of how we can achieve that. Yes, you got me.
In the solar world, then the cosmic radiation is
fine. Exactly, exactly.
In the context of the observation that you began with, how many chances that given the resonance kind of coincidences you are talking about, that the interpretation is actually wrong?
In the sense? Sorry, I didn't follow.
You have certain data. You
correct.
That data.
In many times have we seen these resonant orbits?
No. The fact that you saw that one blip downstairs and then you kept on really putting in seven planets so that you could fit the data. And to me, therefore, the question is whether it's a unique interpretation or... But putting n number, you can always make something of that kind.
No. The interesting thing is integer mixture. Is this the one?
No. Piche. First one. Second slide.
Yeah, this before that, right? So the light curves dip in the dips.
Okay. Oh, these. Achha, okay. Sorry. Okay, this.
No, next one.
Go to the previous one.
Okay. That is the one.
Next one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in this one. Not this one, the previous one.
Okay.
You kept on adding planets till you could get a period.
Correct.
You observed it for some n days or whatever.
Yes.
Large number of planets,
The paper claims that in 20 plus days, not 20 plus, much more than that, they have seen 36 orbit of the largest planetary orbit. So they claim that they have baseline long enough to be able to make that claim.
This is transit. Now they will do the radial velocity. Okay?
No, but transit also. No, the question is, suppose if there is a solar flare sitting in the middle of that, or solar flare sitting in the middle of that, which will mimic this kind of a thing. Or a sunspot, for example, which will mimic that kind. They claim to have seen 36 orbit of even the longest period. And all the other cases, they have a perfect match.
No, but this is the transit.
This match, sorry, this is coordinated from 35 plus orbits. That is the claim of the paper. And that's why we believe that if 36 times you exactly see the planet where you predicted from your first measurement and you continue to see it 36 times, then you believe it.
Yeah, this is this satellite is coming out of Jupiter's shadow. Essentially, that's the same thing that I do.
36 times I predicted, 36 times I got it right.
Well, second related question is, you said this happened at the Spitzer because it was dead and they just...
Correct. See, the thing is, the idea of something that failed to be a star also can have planets, and in fact you are more likely to find habitable planets shows from this result, where now you have started actually seriously observing things that failed to be stars and started looking for planets there. This is an exciting new possibility of where life can exist. Okay, so in that sense, yes, there have been several observations of non or just about star-like objects. We used to originally look at sun like stars, etc., and all kinds of problems occur. But people have now in recent time seriously started working on stars which are less than half the size of the sun, all the way down to the smallest size.
That's what
yes.
You have measured so many parameters.
Yes, sir.
For life to exist.
Correct.
Everything should be fine-tuned.
Correct. Yes, sir.
Being that organized.
Sir.
And he raised this question that what is the chance that there could be another planet other than Earth's life?
Correct.
Now you have this curve.
Yes.
Do you have any other
plans on that? No. This is completely my sticking my neck out, and I'll probably be killed for that sometime soon. When more data comes in. Yes. That's absolutely no data anyway.
I have this feeling that you
know. No, but for example, okay, if you want. Okay, yeah. What I'm saying is that I'm not talking completely through my hat, in the sense that, let me get that graph. If you look at probable planets where life is, then you are talking about a lot of possible sites within the solar system, on moons of Jupiter and Saturn, even on Mars, etc. If you are talking about primitive lives, then they would probably fit into this. And there are 6-7 objects within the solar system itself that can potentially have that kind of primitive life. Where intelligent life, we have only one example. Okay. In that sense, this is not completely nonsense, but it may not be correct.
Because, not so many parameters, we don't know
about
others.
Yes. For example, what this parameter said, frankly speaking, for life, only this many are needed for primitive life. The subsequent parameters are for increasingly more complex life. And those probabilities will keep getting multiplied, and probabilities are less than 1, so each of them will have less of a number. So that is how this guess is made.
This is for existence of life.
So that is how this graph is made. Yes. Correct. Yes. So yes, going from inanimate to animate molecules itself is a very big story.
I think
so.
Can the Hubble telescope throw more light on this now that you know?
Hubble itself is still not good enough. I mean, in the sense, Hubble itself is not good enough. But the next Hubble, the James Webb telescope, will certainly be able to tell you about the atmosphere of all the 7 planets. And they will definitely look at it, because there is a potential that it might be habitable. See, the thing that you look for, one thing is you look for water vapor just to see if there is water in that. But you look for free oxygen or free methane. Both are signs of living systems. Because if you leave oxygen in the air, it will oxidize something and settle down. If you leave methane in the air, it will dissociate and break into its original components. If you see methane, or if you see free oxygen molecule, O2, then you know that there is a living system which is, or at least there is some kind of a chemical regenerative system which is keeping the atmosphere running. So James Webb, certainly this will be among the first targets it will look at. But Hubble is not good enough.
GMRT, can it look for radio emissions?
GMRT, well, I'm not an expert on that. My gut feeling is that if there are intelligent life in the earth which use radio to this thing, then if they have televisions and stuff like that, we'll probably be able to see. SETI, yeah. Okay, what SETI does is to look for specific regular signals. Okay? This, if they have a television program there, it is not going to be a regular signal. Only if they are trying to communicate with you, SETI will catch you. That's a problem with SETI. Yes. Probably they would also think that there are 3 planets within our Goldilocks zone. Also, Goldilocks zone, habitable zone, is also called a Goldilocks zone. There is another issue. Jupiter has moons which can potentially harbor life. So they are in the Goldilocks zone around Jupiter. Jupiter emits more light than it gets from the sun. It is also hot in some sense. It's failed to be a star, but it's still fairly hot inside. So there are Goldilocks zones around planets also. That simply adds to the complication of the story. Yes.
Just like you were telling that the comets were cleaned up by Jupiter away.
Correct.
This will be another capture for you.
Correct.
Even if you have planets in the Goldilocks zone, things will be going towards Jupiter and all that. It will actually increase the collision probability.
Yeah. So we have a whole bunch of ideas of what are necessary conditions. We don't have a Venn diagram which says, okay, if you find this set of things, then definitely there is life. We don't have an overlapping Venn diagram yet. Thank you very much.
Thank you for agreeing to give this talk in such a short notice. Probably I have set a record by giving in within few hours.
Thank you.
So this is something.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Yes, sir.
I'll put it in.
Yeah. Sir, thank you, sir. Dupar ko 12 baje he told me give a talk.
I know. Because today morning I saw in the newspaper. Yeah. So this guy is giving talk today.
Thank you, sir.
But you know, I had just taken my neck out at that time. One fundal asked the question. I said only.